Catching up is an important part of the title for this morning's reflection, and be patient with me. This is going to be a bit of a, feel like a bit of an academic exercise, which makes you crazy, but just hang in there in trying to get through a piece of it. I didn't start in Charlottesville. As you know, many of you know, I was out of the country, and I was without Wi-Fi and good phone service until about August 20th. I didn't know about the Unite the Right rally on August 12th of just a few hundred white nationalists and white supremacists in Charlottesville. They were there to protest the removal of the statue. Was it Robert E. Lee? Of Robert E. Lee. And I didn't know of the peaceful witness of clergy and faith leaders, many of whom were Unitarian Universalists, who were there to block the rally. I didn't know of the woman who was killed by a car driven by one of the Unite the Right people. I learned later then of the follow-up rally the next week in response and the gathering that Wednesday night of several thousand University of Virginia students in protest of the rally and against hate and in solidarity with love. They said it's our home, not their home. I've had to catch up. So in this reflection, I will eventually get there. I will make some progress. I started to type. I will take a few steps. Language matters. And I'll say more about that later. I'll start to catch up by actually going back into November of last fall and a few definitions that we used to begin our series called Race Matters. Many of you were there for that one or perhaps one of the six that we did. The Unitarian Universalist Association distributed these definitions that we used for its anti-racism initiative and workshops 20 years ago in 1997. We use them in ours to build a working definition of racism, and we learn that race isn't something you can define biologically. It isn't existential. We actually created it here in the United States in the late 17th century to use on our social structure to keep indentured servants and slaves apart. We learn that race is constructed in our societies and is usually connected with false assumptions about hierarchical differences that are associated with some distinguishing features. Now, it actually is that race is often put in quotes to show that it is a social construct. As you're sitting there, that doesn't mean that we don't use it to make distinctions among ourselves and the varieties of human groups. We all develop racial prejudices based on race or ethnicity. As the material said, it is part of the air we breathe. It is socialized into every person. But this is where you move. This doesn't mean that everyone is racist. So relax a little right there. Racism is more than racial prejudice. But this brings it back to us. It requires the addition of power. This is a key point for our working definition. Racism is racial prejudice, which we all have, plus the power to sustain that prejudice, to make something real in society about it. Power is required to turn racial prejudice into racism. Racial prejudice becomes racism when one group's racial prejudices are enforced by the systems and institutions of the society, giving power and privilege based on skin color to the group in power and limiting the power and privilege of the racial groups that are not in power. So racism doesn't have to be individual. It doesn't have to be even obviously overt. It just becomes systemic. It's just a part of the evolution, then, of the institutions and structures, the business understandings, and the government. And I can see you folding your arms and tightening up as I say that. Most of us who are here this morning don't notice it. Why? Because we are white. And it's what we live in, because it is just the norm that we grew up in. assumed and unexamined. If somebody were to ask you to describe what it means to be white, could you do that? No, because it's unexamined. We try to address our individual attitudes towards race. That's what we talk about. But we don't notice or try to change the institutional forms of those attitudes. Cultural racism is the assumption that the values, standards, and cultural habits of white people are normative. That's the unspoken understanding for the dominant group, of course, that this is how things should be. It's how reality works. And that cultural racism then supports and sustains both personal and institutional racism. So all this finally catches me up to what we mean when we talk about privilege. The system confers privilege to those for whom it is designed. We understand privilege as what? Advantages and benefits. In a system of institutional and cultural racism, there are unearned advantages and benefits which are derived based on skin color and physical attributes. Simply put, there is privilege that comes by virtue of being born white. As Paul Cavell explains in ways that we may be able to hear, it's not necessarily a privilege to be white. I can see you sitting there saying, I don't know, it doesn't feel like I'm privileged. It's not necessarily a privilege to be white, but it certainly comes with its benefits. Privileges are the economic extras that those of us who are middle class and wealthy gain at the expense of poor and working class people of all races. Benefits, on the other hand, are the advantages that white people gain at the expense of people of color, regardless of economic position. White privilege means that white people, like me, experience advantages and benefits that come from nothing other than being white. They are embedded in the system of institutional racism that I live in and benefit from. In this understanding, my advantage means that other people are disadvantaged. Dismantling racism is not as simple as changing personal attitudes. It requires the reworking and rethinking, the dismantling of the system that confers advantages on the people who control the system. It's hard to get people to give up their advantages. It's hard to get us to look at and reimagine our advantages. I look around the room now, I see furrowed brows, I see folded arms, I see it just coming back at me. But let's start out. I'm a person of many privileges. I like to think I made it to where and who I am on my own merit. It's sort of mixed. I could have done better, you know, and yada, yada. But if I did make it on my own merit, I can then think that anybody can do the same if they only work hard. But hard enough for someone without my privilege is much harder than the effort I ever needed to make. I live in a culture that was designed by people like me for people like me. I like it like that. I can't list all my privileges, but I'll name three that came to my attention this week. First, we talked about the hymn, the privilege of being embodied in a way that allows me to make my way in our society on my own. I can walk up those steps. I can stand behind this podium. I can talk like this. I started to say, leaves me able-bodied, but think how able is defined by the norm of what we demand that our bodies do and how we structure our society and infrastructure around those assumptions and demands. And we all push ourselves to meet those. I can tell you how many people are living here afraid of losing their independence when they can't drive. There is nothing in place to help them get over that barrier. This week, we began our conversations about our upcoming ethical eating programs that we're going to do, and I was confronted with my level of economic privilege. I can make the choices of what to eat for reasons other than concern for having enough to eat. I can choose to eat organic for social justice reasons of not wanting to put people in the field to be exposed to pesticides that I would not expose myself to in order that I have cheap food. But that's because I can afford to make that choice. I can make the choices of what to eat for reasons other than concern for having enough to eat. I can also live where I have access to a diversity of grocery stores and local farmers and farmer markets. I can drive to where they are. I can afford the car and take time from my job to get there while they're open. I now understand that the ethics of eating, if we're going to work with it, has to include an analysis of privilege. I have grown up with male privilege and all it confers. One of the less obvious privileges is growing up with the belief that my opinion counts, my opinion counted, and that I was responsible for sharing it. It was a belief that I was supposed to be heard. Just standing up here on a Sunday morning involves both male and white privilege. I don't really think about my whiteness much. I don't have to, and that's privilege. My approach to the world, my perspective, is for the most part centered in my whiteness. And just as I think I might be catching up a little, the language changes. What we learn to think of as institutional and cultural racism is now being called what? White supremacy. White supremacy emphasizes and includes acknowledgement and naming of the role of power in a way that just saying institutional racism does not. I get that. It's still hard to adjust to from my white centrist view of the world. The recent changes in the governance and management of the Unitarian Universalist Association are being named as a response to white supremacist culture. The president stepped down in the midst of a hiring controversy that began with the hiring of a white male when a person of color was being considered for the job. Two white, top white male managers then stepped down. In an interview on NPR this summer, one of the interim team of three co-presidents appointed by the UUA named the UUA's problem as a mentality of white supremacy that extends and spreads to a culture of domination that impacts everyone. The NPR interviewer Tom Gelton followed up with the thought that a lot of us are thinking. At a time when so much attention is focused on white nationalist extremists and the alt-right movement, the idea of Unitarian Universalists as white supremacists seems a bit far-fetched. But in an interview, Betancourt said she's talking about the very water we swim in. It's not about whether an individual person considers themselves a white supremacist. It's about how we're all influenced by the everyday messages we receive in our culture, by decisions that we make without even really thinking about it. So it's important to pause here, take a breath, and remember what we learned about racism. Just because there is a culture that can be named white supremacy, what? That doesn't mean that we're all white supremacists. We don't need to get defensive. We don't need to focus on the words, argue about those words, and pull back. Because of our privilege, we have the option of doing that, of saying enough of these definitions, enough with this language. We can react and withdraw. We can focus on our disagreement and return to the comfort of normal. If we do that, our circle of compassion and connection constricts. Our heart closes in with our focus and rationalization. I understand how that happens. I do it myself. But our religious traditions call us to do differently. We are called to what? Expand our circle of compassion. Look at your simple reaction to changing the words of standing on the side of love to answering the call of love. Look at the move from when I first said it and you sang the first verse and got to standing on the side of love and had to switch it to answering the call of love, and you stumbled. This is stupid. This is so Unitarian Universalist. We do this to Christmas songs. Why are we doing this here? I'm used to this. Blah, blah, blah. You withdrew. Why change what I know? Then think again about the new words you sang. Answering the call of love. Answering the call of love. Not standing on the side of love. Answering the call of love. Not withdrawing, but moving into what that means. And think how it felt between the first verse and the third verse. I hadn't done that before. I hadn't sung that through before. And I can tell you, for me, I moved into it. That's my song now. We sang what we are called to do. We watched ourselves resist it, and then we answered. I'm reminded about when we did the transgender webinars last year in response to House Bill 2. As Alex Capitan, who led the webinar, opened it, he said what was to be an hour a lot like what I've done this morning of concepts and terminology and reacting to things about, and it was about gender identity and expression. It was a lot to take in. It was a lot to be afraid of messing up. There were a lot of opportunities to get defensive. But he opened by asking for two things: an attitude of openness, and wonder. Rather than close off and return to normal, he asked us for openness, to open our heart. He didn't say that. He just asked for an attitude of openness. And also to wonder. He didn't say more than that. But to drop the cultural demand to have the answers and be the one in the know and the right. To wonder. His simple request has now become one of my understandings for how to move beyond fear and into love. How to not be defensive about my whiteness, about being male, about just start listing them, you know? So what do I do? How to move beyond fear and into love. He actually gave me a practice, a simple practice, and a way to stay engaged. An attitude of openness and wonder. So now we arrive at Charlottesville. I told you we'd get there eventually. And our reading of the words of the president of the UUA, Susan Frederick Gray, who was there and from her experience that day called us to engage in love. Do you have those words, Meg? Can I see them? Yeah. So since she read them in her voice, I'll just tell you, report on this a little bit. Because what Susan said is, it's time for people of faith and conscience, for anyone who is committed to a vision of the beloved community, and especially those of us who are white, to show up and to continue to show up forcefully and nonviolently for love and justice. Our faith calls us to resist violent extremism. Only love can truly confront this corruption that puts our democracy, our liberty, and personal safety at risk. Love is more powerful than any weapon, even when it doesn't feel that way. The faith and the courage of our ancestors and movements of resistance and liberation show us this truth. And then she goes on to conclude by, pages got shifted around, we lift our hearts in prayer for all those whose spirits have been distorted by fear and violence, that they may come to know the capacity for love in their own hearts and spirits. As people of faith, it is this overflowing, deep, abiding love that must guide us to show up again and again for justice, for inclusion, for dignity, and for humanity. If you go to the UUA website and read President Frederick Gray's piece, there are photos from the day. And one of those photos is taken from behind the clergy, kneeling in prayer at the base of a small knoll In front of them are a few armed men, right in front of them. Like they would be kneeling right here, and I would be standing here in paramilitary gear with a gun. And then behind them on the knoll is there are others of that group just milling around. The armed people are from the Unite the Right group. So as I sat with the picture, I saw fear and anger. I saw people armed and dressed for defense and aggression, standing with their guns in their hands. And then I saw people that I thought were my people, unarmed, dressed for love and nonviolence, kneeling and witnessing. And that group that was kneeling was old and young, people of all colors, male and female, all shapes and sizes. And as the Moral Mondays chant says, this is what democracy looks like. This is what love made real looks like. But as I stayed with the picture longer and worked on this reflection, I realized that both could also be seen as being of the same group or being brought together by the same system, just from different perspectives. My focus shifted from merely my reaction to resisting those bad white supremacists, being all caught up in that, which I'm going to do, but to the need to reimagine the system that keeps bringing us all to this place over and over again. I could imagine then the clergy praying for the dismantling of the very system of white supremacy. There were white supremacists and a glimpse at the changing culture of white supremacy together. And there was the prayer of the inclusive power of love to touch them both. So we are not merely standing on the side of love, but truly answering the call of love. For each of us, it means not just defending who we are, but opening to who we might become. Never getting there, but always trying to catch up. Always trying to catch up to love and expanding our circle of compassion.